Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Very good. How are you?
I'm great. Good. Back from vacation, tanned, rested, and ready, and want to talk about all that's gone on since I've been gone and what's going to come up. And I guess the big news right now is that beginning today and then into tonight, the Senate is going to have an extended debate about the war and try to get a vote on or talk about why they can't get a vote on legislation to begin the troop withdrawals.
Right.
And the Senate is kind of impenetrable to me, I have to say. I don't understand the rules very well. You used to work in the Senate. You used to work for Bill Bradley, so
right.
You're the guy to explain to me and the audience here what's going on, and by the time they see this, probably it's going to have happened. But
right.
Nevertheless, explain to me what Reid is up to and what they're doing.
Well, what he's trying to do, I mean, this is, you know, it's not like I worked for one of the great parliamentarians of history, but he did, after 18 years, he did actually do a filibuster once, which required me to actually write the filibuster, which is on a bill about it was called the Utah Wilderness Bill that would have taken a lot of wilderness lands in Utah and opened them up for development. It's kind of, you know, mm-hmm. the typical opposite day world of the of the Senate, and he did. What happened then was that the Republican leadership did what Reid is doing now, which is to say, you want a filibuster, you need to show up and you need to talk, and you need to keep talking and keep talking and talking. So I wrote about, you know, 200 pages full of all kinds of plagiarism about, you know, the beauty of the Utah wilderness. So I have a little familiarity with how these
you didn't have it quoting out of reading names out of phone books.
It wasn't names out of phone books, but, you know, long passages of Wallace Stegner, Bernard DeVoto, you know, all kinds of stuff thrown in there. The great moment, this is an aside, but the greatest moment about this is after he spoke for about, you know, 5 hours about this Senator Hatch from Utah, who was one of the people driving the plunder of his own state, came to the floor and he said, "If I hear one more word from the senator from New Jersey about the silences and solitudes of my state, I think I'm going to be ill." So they made him talk for about 5 hours, and what happens is very often the Senate lapses into this idea that. You know, you need 60 votes to do anything around here, that it's essentially a supermajority institution. And what you forget is that the filibuster is not a supermajority. The point of the filibuster, which I appreciate this, the point of the filibuster is to measure an intensity of commitment. You know, if you are deeply committed to something, you're able to extend the debate on it and keep it going and keep it going until you can be heard. Now, this can, obviously, as in the case of civil rights, I mean, this can result in something being blocked forever. But it can also, this is a classic situation where the Republican, you know, the Republicans have enough votes to win a cloture motion. That is, they can stop the Democrats from getting 60 votes on a piece of legislation to start the troop withdrawal. But they don't have the intensity of commitment
right.
behind that. So that if Reid does what Reid ought to do, which is to say, you want to block this thing, you need to show up, and you need to stand here, and
yeah.
you need to keep working to do it.
It's working for your supper is what he's asking.
It's working for your supper. And that's exactly, in a sense, that's exactly appropriate, because it's going to further reveal the fissures in this whole coalition.
Right.
As people who, you know, people like Voinovich who want to be in a certain position, but they, you know, it's always so hard to get them to actually vote the right way. They can talk, sometimes they'll talk a good game, they understand reality, but party discipline on the Republican side has been so solid over the entire Bush era that the only way to begin to really get people to vote the way they actually think is to force this this drama force them to show up and keep talking and keep blocking it. And it further exposes them on the unpopular side of
right.
you know the the critical issue of our time. So it's a bit of a public relations drama as well as an internal Senate drama. So
and the Republicans did this to the Democrats back in 2003 over some judicial nominees. Isn't that right?
What happens is they always occasionally do it. But the fact is they all have better places to be. I mean, this is when the whole nuclear option was in play in 2005, which was essentially an effort to end the filibuster for judicial nominations. It seemed to me plain as day that the Republicans ought to just say, if the Democrats want to block judicial nominations, they need to show up and they need to actually filibuster them. And I think some of them you would have the intensity of opposition, and some of them, and on some of them you wouldn't. I think that's totally the way to go. But the fact is, if you do that, the Republicans have to show up too.
Right.
And they all have fundraisers to go to, and other fundraisers to go to, and more fundraisers to go to.
Right.
And this isn't the Senate of the Senate of the 50s and 60s was a bunch of men separated from their families with no place particularly that they wanted to be.
Right.
The booze was in the cloakroom. Nobody, there were no TV cameras watching them. It was perfectly good place to be.
Right.
and this is not that. This is not that, and let's say we don't miss that, but it creates for a different environment, and it actually makes.
Yeah, I have to say that the whining about having to stay up all night falls on deaf ears here at the Washington Monthly, where we routinely stay up all night to get the magazine out. So no sympathy for me.
Right. Well, let them read the Washington Monthly as part of the filibuster, and then it'll all come full circle.
Well, so you think? What is your? We're going to put you on the spot here because you're the expert. What is your prediction that will happen in whatever, 36 hours from now, 24 hours from now?
I predict they'll reach some sort of deal that will peel enough Republicans off on some kind of squishy amendment, some version of that Lugar-Warner amendment modified to make it sort of superficially acceptable to the White House, and I don't know, I'm not sure what happens after that.
Okay,
I'm not sure what happens after that. But this is an interesting, I think I was on Blogging Heads with somebody, maybe it was Ross Douthat or somebody like that, who was talking about, the Democratic withdrawal plans and so forth. And I said, if it comes to pass that Congress forces the president's hand, it's not the Democrats, it is the Republican withdrawal plan at that point. I mean, the variable that will make it happen is a Republican variable.
Yep,
so don't call
absolutely.
It a Democratic plan. It will be the Republicans forcing the president's hand.
Many years ago, we back in 2002, I think, we published a piece by Nick Thompson about just how much power the moderate Republicans have in their hands that they have failed again and again to use.
Yeah, yeah.
And I talked to somebody yesterday who was chatting with one of these elder statesmen, moderate Republicans, and asked this person point blank, you've had all these years. Why have you not used the power that you have?
Right.
Back in the day, the Chuck Percys and the John Chafees used so effectively. And that person said, we're scared.
Yeah.
We're scared of the White House. We're scared of the movement conservatives. And so when it happens, these are people like Olympia Snowe and so forth who have very strong views about this. George Voinovich is beginning to show some.
Right.
And this is their moment in history. They'll go down in history as having, this may be the biggest thing they ever do.
Right, right.
And they might as well start now.
But history also will have some explaining to do about what made them so scared and squeamish. I mean, it's a very strange phenomenon. Olympia Snowe is not going to be defeated by a movement conservative. George Voinovich is not going to be defeated by a movement conservative. Voinovich weeps about Bolton and then votes for him, if I have that correctly.
That's right.
I think I have that about right. They all put on this dance, and it will be a long time to really understand what did the White House really have on them. I mean, I saw this when I worked on the Hill. I always saw a difference between, there were a large number of Republicans that one could work with in certain situations, and you always needed that. And they ranged from, they ranged from fairly conservative people. I did a whole elaborate, youth crime prevention thing that involved Senator Domenici and Senator Danforth, and then you had your typical usual suspects like Olympia Snowe. But the only one who would always do what he thought was John Chafee. And yeah. all the others, when you called them and said, you know, would you co-sponsor this amendment or whatever, when you called their staffs, they, you know, and they would check, they would come back and they would say, well, you know, she broke with the leadership last week. She can't do it again this yeah. week. Of course, you're right, but we can't be out there. And I've never understood that. I've never understood it.
Well, you know, it brings to mind my old boss, Bill Clinton's definition of a compassionate conservative. You heard this one?
No.
He has a whole shtick where he goes, he said, what's a passionate conservative? He says, a passionate conservative is somebody who says, I'd like to raise the minimum wage. I really do. I feel bad that I can't, but I just can't.
Right.
I feel bad about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly, exactly. Or it's the ones who have their... you know, I did a thing once, which it was, I really like this post I did on what I called Miss America Conservatives, which is where they have their one little platform issue
right.
of being
yeah.
where they're compassionate, like
yeah.
you
yeah.
know, like Domenici had this mental health thing because his daughter,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
you know. But it's like it extends only to their personal situation and no
right.
further, you know.
Yeah,
Gordon
because they
Smith
have a child
has a certain
who has
amount because his son committed suicide or
right.
whatever, and it's just I called it Miss America because it's like they have their little, you know, their platform,
yeah.
like Miss America.
My dream is to bring. Food to
right,
all the world.
Or it's like literacy education or whatever. And then they go back to the degrading spectacle of the swimsuit competition or whatever, where they basically march in lockstep to whatever they're whatever they're told to do. I was kind of proud of that.
That's great.
But,
that's great. Well, let me kind of move on a little bit here to another issue, which I know you are as fascinated by it as I am, and that is this rash of columns we've been seeing in the last few days. I want to call them Bush's dead enders, but they're
right.
not even that anymore. They're people who for years supported the president and now are writing pieces that are kind of amazing to behold. I'm thinking of people like Bill Kristol, mm-hmm. who had a Outlook piece this weekend. A lot of people have talked about in the Post. Peggy Noonan, who's got a piece in the Wall Street Journal. David Brooks, who has a piece in the Times today. There are some others. Who are the others?
Right. Well, Fred Hyatt. Is
Fred
the
Hyatt
most
from yesterday.
Fascinating, twisted logic.
And I mean, it's very. These are all people who it seems to. They're all writing essentially about the war, about Bush, about his future, his legacy, his resolute ways. Some are trying to even defend him. Most are just, it seems to me, writing a kind of, it's just an amazing spectacle to watch these folks who have to get out there and write every, you know, third day or whatever,
mm-hmm.
every week. And they have amazingly powerful platforms and they have great verbal facility and talent and cleverness, but they have been wrong
right.
in their judgment about the President of the United States in just profound ways
right.
and absolutely wrong about the biggest issue of their time, and yet every day they must come out and write.
Right.
And
right.
they don't want to say that they don't want to kind of admit that their judgment, at the root of their judgment, was something was fundamentally wrong. And so they do this dance, right?
Right, right.
And I don't know, is that how you see it?
I see it, yeah, I know, I totally see it as, I think it's a dance, it's sort of what they can preserve and what they can throw overboard while keeping their authorial attitude.
Right.
So, like, Hyatt is fascinating. I mean, here's a guy who's been, you know, he's driven the whole editorial page in favor of the war. And now he sort of declares, well, you know, basically there's a consensus. What Hillary Clinton is saying is basically the same as what George Bush is saying, which is all the same as, you know, Baker-Hamilton Commission, except Bush needs to create the conditions for the Baker-Hamilton Commission first, and others want to get there first. I mean, it's, you know, it's really from an alternate universe.
Right.
And yet, it allows him to keep his serious, distanced, you know, pose while kind of fitting, almost pretending that Bush is in a whole different category that's not at all where he is.
Right.
I mean, not remotely where he is.
And that the problem isn't the serious people like Bush. It's the Democrats who are sort of out of the mainstream, wanting to get out of the war.
And to add another column to this is also Ann Applebaum's column in the Post today, which is a similar sort of everybody has a theory about Iraq, but none of them are serious. I think what all these guys have in common, all these people, Noonan, Applebaum, Hyatt, Brooks, Kristol, have in common is they've all adopted this serious pose.
Right.
Like, we are serious, others are unserious, which is a thing and a contrast that I would like to rid of a public debate, it's just the worst conversation stopper, It's like one of those things you say in a marriage that just, like, there's, it just, like, stops the discussion, And they're all trying to preserve a tone of their own seriousness and others' unseriousness, even as they take turns of 180 degrees or 360 degrees or something like that to ease themselves out of the weird box they've put themselves in.
And H does it in a sort of different way.
Yeah.
Peggy Noonan, who I don't read all of her pieces, but when I do read them, they seem She's kind of adopted in this particular piece the pose of, like, channeling the average guy. She talks about a middle manager at Verizon in New Jersey, and it's the guy who voted for Bush, and more because he hated Kerry than loved Bush, and now he's sick of all of them. He'd fire Bush, but he can't, so he's just grumpy and waiting it out, and that's sort of where she is too. And that's fine for the Verizon guy in New Jersey to have, voted for Bush and not been happy, whatever. That voter has no larger responsibility.
That's right.
But Peggy Noonan has a responsibility given who she is and the privileged platform she has. And look, every one of these people, I think, owes a duty to themselves and their conscience and their country to say, man, did I screw up. I am so sorry. I just got this completely wrong. And I'm really going to reassess the ideas and the theories and the attitude that brought me to this position. One doesn't admit those kinds of mistakes in public life, but they ought to, I think.
Well, yeah, but I think it's more than... It's more than just the admission of error. It's like change your way. I mean, there's something so... I mean, I don't know. Peggy Noonan just gives me the creeps, frankly.
Right.
There's something just really weird about her. I don't know. I just read a column that she wrote recently about how she was walking along the street on July 4th and some woman was, like, selling something, and she decided to go and say... and say, "Happy July 4th, my friend." And it turned out the woman didn't speak English. And then she's like, "What have we lost in this country when we don't speak a common language and we can't be empathetic towards one another?" Meanwhile, the real point is this woman is out there in, blistering heat, earning minimum wage, baking to death. Whether she speaks English or not, and whether she gets Peggy Noonan's sympathy or empathy is the least of her issues,
Right.
Just a very, very strange... strange character, but I think they're all. I don't know. There's a sort of columnist. I think maybe where the inability to do that is related to a certain columnist attitude that's built in people. I mean, you need a certain authority that you speak with and you keep speaking with, to keep that.
There have been, occasions in among intellectuals who have, changed fundamentally their worldviews. Robert Conquest was a communist and then became an anti-communist, whatever. It's not so much they have to kind of go through a ritual open admission to the public. What they have to do is reassess fundamentally the series of thoughts that led them to write what they write, and vow internally never to do that again, and think about what that means. And I think that they wouldn't be writing quite this way, there's a, but in the case of these guys, there's also an element of access journalism.
Right.
Right? I mean, David Brooks' column today is all about how he spent 4 days interviewing senators and then was ushered into the White House for an hour and 110 minutes to with a lot of conservative columnists to speak with the president. Well, you there's a certain expectation that is built into that offer to come talk with the president, which is I am going to portray him at least for a certain part of my column in the way they want him to be portrayed.
Yeah,
and,
I guess
and I think
so.
He delivered that, and then and you know, I'm as a journalist who likes to have access, I understand the lure of that, and yeah. I could even make an argument for it, but I'm not sure I admire it.
Well, I guess so, but I mean, you could see, you know, Bill Clinton. I mean, you know, obviously, if you're given access to Bill Clinton, you spend an hour and a half talking to Bill Clinton, you know, you're going to get something interesting out of that.
Right.
I think if you spend an hour and a half with George Bush. I don't know. I never have. My guess is you're going to get the same platitudes that you get if you watch a Bush press conference.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not. What is the actual value of spending an hour and a half with George W. Bush?
Right. And what he delivered then was the best possible spin he could put on
right.
the hour and a half where the president, you know, insanely talked about how things are progressing and you know, showed fortitude. Others would call it kind of. Insane stubbornness, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. David Brooks is a sui generis in some ways, and I find myself reading him, but every third column just shaking my head.
And I sort of swore off the habit of it's sort of the easiest blogging habit is to bash David Brooks today.
Right, you know? Right, yeah.
And I sort of swore it off a little bit. But, you know, I mean, he's also, I wrote a piece once about how I think one reason he aggravates people is he's the closest thing to a not old columnist there is. You know? I mean, he's 46 years old or something
yeah.
like that. He's the only columnist on any of those pages under 50.
Right. Right.
With the and Applebaum, who I went to college with, is obviously under 50, but doesn't tend to write about domestic politics that much. And
yeah.
doesn't live in the U.S. at the moment.
Well, instead of bashing David Brooks, let's bash John McCain.
I love bashing John. That I've never sworn off.
Right. Well,
I never get tired of it.
The news, as everybody knows, is that. Staff is leaving. Has been leaving his campaign. He's bleeding money. He lost, I guess, yesterday some more press staff. In addition to the key advisors he lost last week. There's been a lot of conversation, sort of longish, sort of strongly argued pieces, especially in the blogosphere, about what killed John McCain's campaign.
Right.
Arianna Huffington on Huffington Post started it off by saying it was his support for the war.
Mm-hmm.
A number of people, including Glenn Greenwald over at Salon, said, no, it's got nothing to do with the war. On that, he is in agreement with all the other candidates Republican candidates, who are doing just fine. It's
if you consider where Tommy Thompson and those guys are just fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Sam Brownback. But
yeah.
What people like Nikki Haus are saying. It's immigration. He
right.
he defended immigration, and that's what killed him. I'm going to offer a very kind of quarter baked theory, and I won't try to defend it because I haven't really thought it all the way through. But my quarter baked theory, and this is only a piece of it, is. We're seeing the oft-mentioned deleterious effects of being a senator.
Mm-hmm.
Because John McCain is a senator, he's called upon constantly to talk about Iraq and to talk about immigration. These are issues that, as a senator, he is involved in. And he's, partly through his own personal style and partly because of his position in the Senate, focusing on these issues that you need to vote on and make policy on right away and not spending a lot of time talking about America's role in the future or jobs in the future or whatever. There's not a lot of forward thinking coming out of John McCain.
Right.
But that's my quarter-baked theory, and
right.
I know you've written a very good piece on Talking Points Memo, so I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I did it on The Guardian, actually.
On The Guardian, that's right.
Yeah, I think... I think that's true in theory, although it's possible to find a way outside of the Senate to do things. I mean, the most interesting thing to me is the way that John McCain, you know, the role he played in American politics from, you know, 2000, 2001 until basically last week, which is bizarre, because he was kind of the broker of bipartisanship.
Right.
And he kind of understood that where bipartisanship was a scarce resource, he could kind of you know,
corner
the market on it and control it, and therefore actually deliver it to Bush when needed. So that,
well, that's the key point.
I mean,
that's,
you know,
the
yes,
point.
Everybody has to vote on every senator has to vote on immigration, and they can do that. But for McCain, it was a thing that you needed to be, because that needed to be handled with the bipartisan space, and Bush Cheney didn't do that. Whenever anything needed to be bipartisan, there was McCain. Climate change, there's McCain. Immigration, there's McCain. Campaign finance reform, yes, it was an important issue to him. It symbolized a lot about his early campaign and so forth, but it was also, it's the only instance where a bipartisan bill was kind of forced onto the president. Most of the time, though, what McCain did was, like, rush into that space, as on, you know, the classic example was on the torture legislation, rush into that space, become the broker of the deal, and then
right.
essentially deliver the deal to Bush.
Right.
You know, deliver something that wasn't so bad for Bush. That didn't quite happen on climate change, but that's, you know, he was just going to be there. And as a result, there was no opportunity to do any other kind of maneuver that might force something onto Bush's hands. Now, I find this weird for a couple reasons. One, I mean, it's, you know, going back to the period when I worked in the Senate, John McCain was not an effective senator. You know, I wrote in the Guardian piece about this time when I saw him, you know, come, you know, one of these typical, I mean, it's not new for the Senate to work late at night. One of these typical late nights, he comes to the Senate floor with an amendment to lift the Social Security earnings limit, which has since been lifted, but for, you know, how much money seniors can earn and still collect Social Security. Since been changed. It was very expensive at that time. Anything you did had to be paid for. And, you know, he was totally unprepared. He offered this amendment, and, you know, it got 20 votes. And then he just stood there ranting for half an hour about how stupid his colleagues were, and then left.
Right.
This is not the recipe for how you get things done in the Senate. And so to see him turn into this, you know, critical power broker for this period was amazing. And I think what he got in return was he got that backing from Bush to be kind of the mainstream Republican candidate,
mm-hmm.
which we all believe the Republicans go with their mainstream candidate. And then he was sort of in a box. He had his supporters from 2000, and he had campaign staff from 2000, people like Rick Davis and folks like that.
Right.
He maintained this thing called the Reform Institute, which, by the way, is a total fraud, because it's a nonprofit that he maintained, which had thousands and thousands of donors, which he basically used to keep his list of donors from 2000 going. So he's ready to, like, restart the 2000 campaign with the Bush backing. So the first quarter, they have their bad fundraising totals, and it's clear that in that quarter they went after...
They lost the reformers.
They went after those reformers from 2000. That group did not deliver. He dumps his finance team. He brings in this Bush guy, Tom Leffler. You know, they're going after the Bush donors. And now the Bush staff in his campaign, the Terry Nelsons and so forth, are in the ascendance, right? They don't deliver either. So he sort of made this, you know, move back to where he was, back to core Bush, and neither of them are working at the moment that he did it. So leaving aside any of the individual issues, I mean, I think the price he paid for playing this strange role of being the broker of deals on Bush's behalf in exchange for the mainstream Republican support just put him in a box that there's no way out of, and that's manifested in the, you know, all the personalities and the, you know, all the story, all of them talk, so all these stories, you know, the behind the scenes stories, mm-hmm. are great, of, you know, Terry Nelson, Rick Davis, John Weaver, so forth, but they represent the different poses that are basically incompatible, so it's
right.
It's neither an issues problem nor a personality problem, but an obvious outgrowth of kind of the particular way in which he chose to sell his soul. And now he's done. And I don't think there's a role for McCain in American politics right now. I think he's, you know, he's an angry senator again.
Yeah, well, let me just respond to that. And I think that's a very unique and brilliant way of putting it. I think it's right. I think it's also true that pretty much the, I mean, this is the really simple kind of analysis, and that is, as soon as he decided, and your analysis would be wrapped up in this, as soon as he decided to be basically become Bush's guy, it was over.
Right.
Because he decided to do that at a time when John Weaver was telling him, and many others were telling him, this is the, this is your only way to the top. I mean, remember, in 2003, we put on the cover that John McCain should run for president as a Democrat.
Right.
And I still think if he'd done that, he'd have a shot at it.
Right.
His best shot at it. I didn't think that running as a Republican was his best shot. But he decided to change from being the reformist, centrist, anti-Bush to being one of Bush's... He didn't just, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, give a couple of speeches at a key moment late in the 2004 race. He went out and hustled for Bush in every possible way.
Right.
And I think that it really sickened a lot of very plugged-in, independent-minded people. And had Bush been, in 2007, a powerful and popular president, it would have been a smart strategy. But he turns out to have been a failure, and McCain went with him. I mean, I think it's just kind of as simple as that, but things are never that simple.
Right, right. I think that's right. And then there's also the question of whether McCain got boxed out by supporting the surge. You know, if he'd been able to tell the story of, oh, I supported the surge, but that wasn't tried, and instead some other thing was tried.
That would have been perfect for
him.
That
would have been perfect for him. I've always...
He could run us on the lost cause.
He could run on the lost cause, and he could also potentially do it as an independent. You know, I mean, I still believe that there was a moment, I don't know, last fall, last summer, when there was almost a deliberate plotting for the McCain-Lieberman ticket.
Right, no question.
With each of them being able to say, I was rejected by the extremists in my own party, therefore I am the true centrist. Even though both of them are actually extreme conservatives.
Right.
And that's why I've never bought that McCain should run as a Democrat. McCain's not a natural Democrat, and that's fine. And it turned out he wasn't really an independent-thinking Republican either.
No,
you know.
No. Right. That you're right about that.
Yeah.
Well, prediction, is McCain going to be able to, it's going to be able to muscle his way back in?
No. Absolutely not. I mean, he doesn't have any of the assets that Kerry had, and he has to overcome the perception of age, and that's way too little money to go forward with, and a mess of an organization. The Kerry comeback in 84 has to give anyone a little bit of pause about making predictions like that. And there is the problem that all the other potential Republicans seem implausible also.
Right.
But I think I've always thought of the Rudy McRomney three, McCain would be the first to fall. And I think another one of those two will fall, at least one of them will fall as well.
Yeah.
But, I've got so much staked on the idea that Newt Gingrich is going to be the Republican nominee that I've got so many bets out there that I can't really be objective anymore.
Okay. Well, let's talk about something completely different.
Okay.
Now for something completely different. The Washington
still in the wonky sphere, however.
Yes. No, still very wonky. In fact, incredibly wonky subject of whether states can deliver universal health care. Now, Ezra Klein in the July-August issue of the Washington Monthly has this piece that says it's wonderful that Mitt Romney's Massachusetts and Arnold Schwarzenegger's California have put forth plans. In Massachusetts, they've actually implemented them. Schwarzenegger is talking, and a number of other states like Illinois are contemplating universal health care plans.
Right.
And it's a sort of help give... a boost to the national discussion of universal health care, the fact that you've got these sort of Republicans who have put their imprimatur on it with, really, these are Democratic legislative efforts for the most part that these Republican governors have supported. It gives it a bipartisan sheen, and so that's all great, but what Ezra argues is states, for fundamental fiscal and regulatory reasons, have never been and can never be the delivery mechanisms of universal health care.
Right.
And I will go through all the examples that Ezra puts forth, but fundamentally, the kind of the simplest way of putting it is that when states, that the vast majority of whom cannot deficit finance, hit periods of economic recession, it's at exactly at that moment when their revenue stream that they need to fund a health care, a big health care program, begins to decline, just as the number of people who need help with their health insurance because they're losing their jobs skyrockets.
Right, right.
And that's the only way that they can close that gap is to go to the federal government, and the federal government seldom will bail them out.
Right.
And so we've seen again and again and again, going back to Hawaii in the early 1990s, and Oregon, and Tennessee, and a number of states have attempted in different ways to create universal health care programs, and they've all failed.
Right, right, right.
And what Ezra's saying is these will fail too.
Right.
And so progressives especially need to get their heads around this fact and realize that this is a jumping-off point for efforts to create universal health care at the national level.
Right.
Anyway, this piece came out and was immediately attacked by a couple of progressives in the blogosphere. One of them was David Sirota over at the Huffington Post, and another was Nathan Newman over at Talking Points Memo. And you then took those guys on in a brilliant essay, and so I'm going to just sort of ask you to tell the audience, what did Sirota and Nathan say, and what did you say in response?
All right, well, you know, poor Ezra needs a defender because, you know, he's out there all by himself getting beat up.
That's right.
But I have to say it's better that, you know, David Sirota, who's a friend of mine, never holds anything back in one of his attacks. And, you know, my favorite of his attacks was when he declared that Matt Yglesias and I were responsible for every Democratic presidential loss since 1980.
Yeah.
Which
I agree with, by the way.
It might be true, but the problem is, it leaves me solely responsible for 1980 and I think 1984, because Matt wasn't even born yet. But when I was 16, I was definitely a bad influence on the Democratic Party myself.
Of course. Yeah, well, David's written for us too, but he is merciless.
He is merciless, and we need a little mercilessness. But what I found interesting about basically their attack was these D.C. These inbred D.C. elites. Look down on the states. They treat them as toys. They treat them with scorn. They don't appreciate that there's true democracy in the states, and you can never get anything done in the federal government anyway. What's interesting to me about this is just the point that I tried to draw out in the piece I wrote on TPM Cafe is there's an interesting historical arc here where it used to be that it was kind of the essence of liberalism was federal programs, federal standardized, fair federal programs, and some of that comes out of the civil rights movement, because you know that there are a dozen or so states that are not going to treat their citizens fairly unless you have a federal, you know, a program that requires them to, or that delivers benefits directly to them. Part of it comes out of, you know, the New Deal, in the sense that if you're going to take on big problems, if you're going to do rural electrification or something like that, that's just a bigger thing than any state can do on its own. And part of it is the kind of the growth of expertise in the sense of expertise in technocratic solutions as part of liberalism. And then there comes a point, and there's a delusion to that, because there's still a lot you can do with states, and there are whole issues that really don't have a federal role. I mean, we don't do criminal justice at the federal level, for example.
Right.
And so there comes a point. I mean, I've always, you know, the welfare reform fights of the mid-90s kind of shaped a lot of my thinking, and there was, you know, actually the turning of the whole thing over to the states in a block grant was more significant than the work requirements. And so us liberals were kind of standing against, you know, pushing this against this tide of trying to stop this block grant. And frankly, probably would have accepted, people like Moynihan would have accepted a lot of work requirements in exchange for stopping that tide. But then you come around and realize, okay, A, this is a reality. I mean, states now have this responsibility. We can work with them. And B, there's a ton you can do in states. There's a kind of a more problem-solving attitude sometimes in state legislatures as opposed to the ideological warfare of Washington. If you build up the institutions to do a good job in the states, you can make plenty of progress at the state level. So there's a sort of trend towards kind of progressive devolution developed in the 90s. And I did a lot when I was at the Open Society Institute, and I was a funder, actually helped fund a lot of these things. So I helped create this whole network of state budget think tanks that are kind of modeled on the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities at the national level.
I just want to break here just to make one point, and that is it actually way predates the 90s. Mm-hmm. One of the more famous...
Wait a minute. A Washington Monthly essay.
No, actually, I'm not going to talk about it, although we probably reviewed the book. There was a book by David Osborne back in 1988, and I think it was called Laboratories
right.
of Democracy.
Yeah, right,
and it
right.
was profiles of governors, and among the governors was Mike Dukakis and I think Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. but also John Engler, I think maybe Tommy. The guy from Michigan. Anyway, profiles of
Blanchard,
these governors.
Blanchard,
that's right.
Democrat. Yeah.
And David Osborne's a kind of centrist. He was once a kind of 60s-ish kind of new left kind of guy, but became very wonky. And the whole emanating spirit of this book was that under the Reagan administration, a lot of the notions of innovative problem solving, especially in the social realm, had stopped, and that banner of progressivism was being picked up by state governors.
Right.
So I would date it back to then, and I was reporting back then from the states, and that really was true. And
right.
Bill Clinton came in all full of enthusiasm for federalism.
Right. And of course, you did have those state health care. Some of the state health care experiments that Ezra was writing about are from the that immediate period, late 80s, early 90s, and that's part of what made people think you could do health reform. A lot of the work on education in the 90s. I think as an explicit progressive strategy, though, it kind of picked up in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And the idea that you didn't need to have federal programs and you could do these things and you need to really turn some attention to the states, not just say, oh, governors can do a good job, but actually turn some real attention to what you needed to encourage that state policy. So
right.
I guess my only point was that I thought that some of Ezra's attackers had taken this whole thing way too far in the other direction now.
Absolutely.
There's actually a moral superiority to states, as if what goes on in Albany or Springfield is actually, morally superior to Washington, D.C.
Which is far from the case.
And so forth, and that in fact you had to admit there are certain things that there are real, real limits to the kind of health policy you're going to do at the state level. You're going to be very dependent on federal revenues in the first place that are, there are all these things like the Schwarzenegger plan in California, and at the heart of them is like games that you play to actually maximize your drawdown of Medicaid and SCHIP
yeah.
money.
And they're all based on magic asterisk.
Right.
We're going to get $10 billion of funding from the federal government over the next 10 years.
Right.
Now, what I think Nathan Newman said, and I thought this was a pretty smart point that I would love, I'm not sure you addressed, because it was in response to your piece, I think,
right.
was, look, we've had more success at the federal level getting consensus on shoveling money for health care to the states than we have doing big health care reform at the federal level. So you see money for the SCHIP program and other things having been ratcheted up over the years, even under Republicans or
right.
even with a Republican Congress.
Right.
And so that is the path to getting money to health care, and follow that path. That's the easiest way.
Right. Well, although it creates a very limited... you know, essentially that that excludes a lot of solutions that would get you to real universal coverage, and they're fighting about SCHIP right now.
That's right.
And there's no assurance of that. And it also gets, I mean, the cover-all kids is kind of the low-hanging fruit of universal health care.
Right.
I mean, you can, most states that aren't named Alabama can get there. I mean, Howard Dean got there in Vermont. I mean, it's not that hard between SCHIP and Medicaid, and if you have a manageable population and a good baseline. It's not that hard to cover all kids, and it's actually, you know,
the money has been there to cover a lot more anyway.
Right.
The kids, we've had problem getting kids signed up.
Yeah, yeah, because it's an awkward system. If you have a clean universal system, you're not sort of trying to rope kids into this poverty program called SCHIP.
Right, which nobody's heard of.
Which nobody's heard of, and I mean, different states portray it in different ways, but you know, I mean, they also spend, to do it right, you need to spend a lot of money advertising it and so forth. A seamless system would get a lot of people in, and you can't, it's very hard to do a seamless system at the state level, and you're going to wind up relying typically on employer mandates, which I think are going to be of limited value.
Well, I agree with you, and I thank you for
right.
for writing that, defending Ezra.
Thank you. He needs it.
He needs it.
Poor guy.
He does.
He has no outlets. He can't defend himself.
Yeah. Well, he's not the cleverest guy in the world.
No, Ezra.
No. But we love him anyway.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of pieces in the Washington Monthly, I wanted to ask you if you'd seen the cover story of the latest Washington Monthly. It's a speech, quote unquote, from Ted Sorensen. We asked Ted Sorensen, of course, JFK's aide and collaborator on the most important of JFK's speeches, to write a speech that he would like to see the Democratic nominee, whoever he or she is, give in this time next year at the convention, the Democratic
right.
convention in Denver.
Right.
And we told him, look, don't worry about making it politically correct. Don't worry about figuring out which candidate might give it. Just write it. Write your dream speech. And so he sent it back in, and we published it. And we've gotten some interesting feedback, I think. But I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at it. But we're real proud of it.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great.
And the other thing that's in that package that I was hoping to get your thoughts on is my own essay, which basically makes the argument that there are many great speeches from presidents that we no longer remember anymore.
Right.
Because the presidencies themselves were disasters.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, we're looking at, I think, this President Bush. I'm a kind of angry admirer of his rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
From day one, I thought that his speechwriters were awfully good, and though I think his delivery of speeches is not good at all, and his ability to extemporize is the worst I've ever seen in a president,
mm-hmm.
the actual delivery of speeches, I mean, the actual speeches themselves are quite well crafted and brilliant.
Uh-huh.
But save for maybe the speech that he gave right after September 11th to the joint session of Congress, I'm not sure that high school valedictorians are going to be quoting George Bush in 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 years
right.
the way they quote John F. Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt
right.
and Ronald Reagan. What's your thought?
Well, I'm sure that's the case, and I've never been particularly impressed by Bush's either his speeches or his delivery of them. I mean, I've never seen anything other than perhaps, I was thinking of the National Cathedral speech after September 11th. I remember thinking was pretty good, but maybe we were all just traumatized at that time. You know, nothing that compares to Reagan, who I thought was amazing in the sense that he could deliver any writer, he could do justice to any writer's speech, and he had, you know, a set of speech writers who had very different voices, one of whom was the crazy Peggy Noonan, but you know, he just did perfect justice to that speech. I think there are writers who can, there are politicians for whom a certain speechwriter can pull something off, mm-hmm. in their can really work with their voice, and others really can't. And there's and then they're. There are some who can really get the most out of any writer, and you know, and I don't even have a consciousness of Bush's. I don't have a real sense of Bush's writers. I mean, I have a little bit of a sense of the sort of spiritual tone that Michael Gerson introduced, and a little bit of a sense of the sort of, you know, obviously the axis of evil stuff that David Frum introduced, but not that much. Not that much beyond that. And I and no, it's hard to imagine. There's a speech that. That will, you know, that will be remembered into the future. Although he's got 18 months to go, he can still give it. He can give his with the withdrawal from Iraq speech might be a great Gettysburg
true.
Address of
that's true.
Of his era. I mean, you sort of always wonder: is there some moment where he's going to wake up and say, "Why did I tie myself to Dick Cheney? Why did I do?" Yeah, you know. There, I mean, I don't know. I still
apparently
have,
not.
Yeah, I know. I still.
I
have
mean,
a,
from every indication, he keeps doubling down. But I just. You know, we think of speeches and rhetoric, and you were a speechwriter. I was a speechwriter.
I wasn't a very good one, but
Well, I'm not sure if I was good or not, but I was delivering them for a master,
right?
Bill Clinton,
right.
And you know, we thought ourselves fortunate if he would use 50% of what we wrote because,
right.
But the speeches were always twice as long because he always added
right.
his own riffs and so
right.
forth.
Right. My first job for Bill Bradley was as a speechwriter, which he hadn't had before. And I always felt like my basic role was, if he didn't have a speechwriter, he would lock himself in his office for 3 days, staring at the blank screen and then writing something. Whereas if you hand somebody something that's, even if it's bad,
right.
you reduce the time from 3 days to 1 day, you know.
Right.
Because you don't have a blank screen, you have this crap that you're going to turn into something else.
Well, we think that we have a lot of power,
yeah.
Or that rather, if not we, that a politician with his words has power, and I think that it's one must not underestimate it is one of the chief weapons in a president's arsenal.
Right.
But in the end, people respond. In the end, history doesn't judge speeches by their rhetorical brilliance; it judges them in the same way that it judges the presidencies.
Right.
And so a great speech by a president who was a failure,
right.
And there are some. I mean, Warren G. Harding was quite a good speech giver, as it turns out, an ex-newspaper editorial writer and publisher and eloquent in his own way. Richard Nixon delivered some marvelous speeches. One of the best inaugural speeches of the 20th century was his his first inaugural. And yet nobody quotes Warren G. Harding, and nobody quotes, at least not favorably,
right.
Richard Nixon's
right.
speeches.
Sure. Sure.
And I fear that will be the legacy of for George Bush.
Right, and that's the least of his issues. And of course, you know, the malaise speech, Jimmy Carter's malaise speech, is a fascinating document.
Because he never said the word malaise,
He never
right?
said the word malaise, but it was a fascinating document of its time. You know, and it really captures that sense of that sense of everything kind of falling apart at that moment,
mm-hmm.
and all the post-war confidence kind of falling away very quickly.
Yes.
In that late 70s era, and it's mocked, and it doesn't deserve to be mocked because it was an attempt to build a politics around a sense of shared sacrifice.
No,
and shared effort that and reduced expectations that I think we're going to have to be thinking about in the future.
No, that's a great example. I wish I'd put it in the essay because I think Rick Hertzberg, who worked on that speech,
mm-hmm.
who at the very least was a speechwriter for Carter, wrote a piece in the New Yorker I think some time ago that followed by a big bump in the polls for Carter.
Yeah,
it was very, very well received.
Yes.
But a few days later, he had the Saturday Night Massacre where he asked his entire cabinet to resign, and that was seen as a kind of move of desperation and a sign of a lack of vision and organization. And now we attribute, you know, we attribute the malaise speech to that. But in the end, it was the failure of Carter to be a terribly successful president. That leads to our not quoting the malaise speech
right.
at least not affirmatively.
Right. What have you thought about, you know, I mean, when it comes to speeches at the moment, I mean, Obama is the candidate who seems to be doing the most with rhetoric.
Yes.
Alone this year. And it's been interesting to me to see. I felt like there was a, there have been a series of speeches that kind of had, you know, you could hear the speechwriter's voice, but you couldn't see any Obama in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like his speech on health care, his health care proposal, which, you know, I defend the proposal, but I thought the speech was, you know, the most boilerplate health care speech. There was a set of boilerplate speeches, and then all of a sudden I felt like he turned it around again and gave a speech at a church in, I think, Hartford. You know, a set of speeches where all of a sudden they're Obama speeches again.
Right.
And the personal experience and the rhetoric, you know, they're not trying to do it all with policy, and they're not trying to do it all with anecdotes about some person in the audience and all those standard tricks, that they're right back to where he is. And I don't know if you've noticed the same.
I hadn't, but now that you mentioned it, and I would put the speech that he gave, I think it was at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, which is his big kind of opus on national security and America's role in the world, somewhere in between, because it was quite a good speech, and it was a kind of definitional, you know, is Obama going to be a leader of the free world, or is he going to be allow his vote against the Iraq war to define him, and he did the former. So I think it's also a measure maybe of his inexperience, in that he's not lived with the healthcare issue a long time, and he's not developed a voice around it and strong principles. Right, it's probably something that he's muscling his way through to learn and have views on.
Right,
but the best of him is not engaged in that.
Right, although and it's also I think a transition that you have to make, where you really do have the luxury for a certain period of your life, of if you want to give us, and you're a naturally gifted writer, as Bill Bradley was, as Obama is, you know, of you can if you want to lock yourself in a room and write a speech for three days, you know.
Yeah.
And if you're going to run for president, you absolutely can't. You need to learn to make the most of something that somebody hands you, you know, a few hours before, and you actually all you have is a little time in the car to cross some things out and maybe change some other things.
Yeah, and make it your own and bring the audience into
and
it.
Make
and
it your own. Yeah.
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 Well, we'll. I mean, I think none of the candidates other than Obama is truly, I think, gifted at that. John Edwards has his gifts.
Right.
Hillary is not at all good at the delivery of speeches, although she's actually quite good at the give and take of Q&As and so forth.
I think she's actually fine at the delivery of speech. You know, perfectly adequate. Let's put it that way. I mean, she doesn't bring you down.
Yeah,
she knows what an audience is. And
yes, you know, she does, but she holds back on the speeches.
Yeah.
And she's not herself, and it feeds all the wrong things when she kind of... I mean, she almost lowers her voice when she speaks. I don't know. I haven't figured it out, but I'm not at all fond of the way she's delivering set speeches. But have any of the other candidates gained your notice as speech givers, even on the Republican side?
I can't say they have, but I must say I've never seen a Tommy Thompson speech. I've never seen a Sam Brownback speech.
Well,
I've seen McCain could be, you know, he could do okay, again, in a small crowd with, if he brings a sense of humor and all that, but he's not a candidate anymore, so it doesn't really matter. I don't think I've ever really seen a Mitt Romney speech either.
I was going to say, people say that, you know, Josh Marshall can't stand the Mitt Romney speech. Yeah. He just thinks he's listening to a salesman, a pitchman.
Right.
Others have said he's extremely adept at it. So I look forward to seeing
it. We'll go out there and check it out. Well, we should wrap up soon. Are you just back from vacation?
I am. I was 2.5 weeks in my grandparents' homeland of Greece with my family, my mom and my brother, and we had a great time. And being as this a political thing, I should kind of figure out a political thing to say about my vacation. The way David Broder writes about the upper Michigan. The one thing I'd say is that I've been going to Greece now for many years, probably my 10th trip, and anti-Americanism is always there.
Right.
But the anti-Americanism is definitely spiked. And if it spiked in, you know, from its already high level in Greece, you know, Greece has issues with America going back to when the country, when America ran the country in the 50s
right,
and 60s
right.
and sided
so
with
they
the Turks.
Some legitimate rights,
they do,
yeah.
they do, but they're also pretty hardcore about it in ways that aren't helpful for either of us. But in any event, my relatives just, they love me and we love them and we had a wonderful time. And but boy, you know, at a certain moment they just had to let it out how angry they were.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, we learned a few tricks to kind of lower the temperatures a little bit. And I mean, really the simplest one is I didn't vote for George Bush. And
right,
that seems to go a long way.
Right, right.
So my, I don't know if you're going to get out of the country this year or with your family.
No, I think all we are doing is a week in Avalon, New Jersey. And I think the only political angle to Avalon, New Jersey is, this is, you know, it's on the Jersey Shore, and the only people who go to Avalon, New Jersey are people from Philadelphia. And
I see.
Have no Philadelphia connection whatsoever, so how we wound up there, I don't know. But it's a nice place to go. It's a town full of people, you know, I sometimes argue over the, you know, the group Third Way that puts out all these reports saying, you know,
yes.
all this populism is baloney, American, you know, the real median income of America is like, you know, American families is like $85,000 or something like that, and they're all driving Lexuses and they're all happy and don't complain about it. You know, Avalon, New Jersey is like a Third Way report on the beach, because everybody there, they're basically, you know, they're not white collar people. They're Philadelphia electrical contractors and things
right.
like that. And they drive Lexuses and have nice houses. But don't get. I try to, you know, keep my economic populism intact even during my week at the beach at Avalon.
Yeah, I would spend a week at Plymouth because we got a beach house that was very cheap, and I didn't realize this, but Plymouth is the heart of kind of swamp Yankee working class. Massachusetts,
uh-huh.
and got in all kinds of political arguments with the pro-Bush folks back then.
Yeah.
This was in 2004. So,
uh-huh.
yeah, it is eye-opening.
It's good to go to just a totally different place. Not,
it
you know, not, the usual, not your usual Nantucket or whatever.
Right.
Wherever usually vacation.
Well,
summer,
well
wherever usually summer, wherever the Glastris is, normally summer.
Well, we normally summer at my mom's house in St. Louis too often, but we were able to get a little Europe in this time.
Yeah.
So, hey,
well,
Mark,
good.
It's been a great time.
Good to
chatting.
Talk to you, Paul. No,
we'll do it again soon.
We found no disagreements, so next time we'll find some more vicious disagreements.
I hope we can.
Okay, be well, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.